Well, good morning, everybody, and thank you very much for the invitation to speak to you all. And thank you, Joy, for the introduction. So, yes, I'm a professor at the University of Oxford. I have always worked throughout my research career looking at the relationship between government, technology, public policy, and the sphere of governance more generally. And for these reasons, when the National Institute for Data Science and AI, the Alan Turing Institute, was set up about 7 years ago, I was very interested because I've always been excited about the possibility of large-scale data and the latest generation of technology to kind of make the world a better place. And I thought that there should be part of the National Institute that focused on the public good. So that's what I'm going to talk about today. I'm going to talk about artificial intelligence and public services, public decision making, public governance, all the things that might help AI to make the world a better place. And improve citizens' lives. And then I will also talk about some of the risks that the previous speakers have mentioned and how we might manage them and what are the things we should worry about and perhaps a little bit about what are the things that we shouldn't worry about. Okay, so what is AI? Apologies to the AI experts here, and I know there will be some. But it is a good idea to start there because artificial intelligence is are words that have kind of morphed into different meanings over the years. So first of all, what is AI? What happens if you Google artificial intelligence? Well, the first thing you learn is that artificial intelligence is blue. Most of these images are blue. And then you kind of get the idea that it's about either people turning into machines or machines turning into people, becoming ever more like people. It seems to be a kind of merging of brains. But then over here we have an image that has perhaps gained particular currency lately, that somehow artificial intelligence might be going to destroy all of us, destroy every human being on the planet at the same time, as one Guardian article put it a few months ago. So actually Googling AI is not really that helpful. So let's go back to the beginning. So artificial intelligence was actually originally a subdiscipline of computer science. And it was being talked about and developed already in the 1950s as exactly that. And I want to say something that some of you will know for sure, but perhaps not everybody will know, that at the major conference in Dartmouth in 1956, where a group of computer scientists, not just computer scientists, I should point out, for example, the polymath, the psychologist and professor of public administration and all kinds of things, Herbert Simon, was one of the people was there. But they were talking about what to call this new discipline. What should we call it? And there were two factions in the group. One part of the faction thought it should be called artificial intelligence. And the other faction in the group thinks it should have been called complex information processing. Now, you can see that was quite an important point, because if it had been called complex information processing, when you woke up this morning and thought about what time you were going to get here, you might have looked at the programme and think, oh, God, she's going to talk about complex information processing. Maybe I'll just sleep in a bit and come a bit later. But it wasn't. It was called artificial intelligence, and that has been capturing the kind of human imagination and public commentary ever since. The fact that the idea that this is about somehow replacing humans or getting at the essence of what it means to be human with a technology. So that was quite an important point, and I'll come back to that, because I think there are ways in which it would have been better if it had been called complex information processing, even if you'd miss my talk as a result. But this was the basic, this is the kind of basic idea of artificial intelligence. It performs tasks that do require intelligence when done by humans. And I think that is basically the kind of best general definition. Because basically, artificial intelligence has become a sort of catch-all term for recent technology developments. And I'll put all of them up because they all reinforce each other. Basically, around about 2012, we got the concept of big data, which was really born out of the internet revolution. Suddenly, everywhere we're going, first of all on the internet and the World Wide Web, then on a whole array of digital platforms, and gradually also just on our phones in our pockets, we were all generating data. There was just so much data, digital data around with which you could do things. That led to storage becoming cheaper and cheaper. It led to better machine learning algorithms, because machine learning, like, which is really the workhorse of AI, is trained on data. And so you can make better and better algorithms. That kind of artificial intelligence they were talking about in the 1950s was much more about kind of typical sort of symbolic code. If this, then do that. It wasn't data driven, not in the way that technologies are data driven now. And that is one of the key differences of artificial intelligence. It started to get greater computer power. And of course, if you think about ChatGPT and large language models, which people have already talked about, I mean, they have had literally billions in computer power invested in them, and that's why they are impressive. And that means larger and larger in investments. I think Microsoft has put about 12 or 13 billion already into OpenAI, for example, that created ChatGPT. So all these words under there, which are all kind of things that have gone into what we are calling AI, have arisen from these kind of four drivers that have been around for the last 10, 15, 20 years. And you will find artificial intelligence being used to describe almost anything. It could be used to describe a regression. It could be used to describe a robot, or it could be used to describe ChatGPT. You've seen a real billowing out of what's called AI, and then you at some points you've seen a sort of narrowing. When people talk about AI, they only mean ChatGPT. None of those things are right, but I hope that short explanation sort of gets us on the same page. Now, away from those killer robots that are going to destroy us all, which we've heard a lot about, what do people actually feel about AI? Now, that's a really difficult thing to ask. I work at the National Institute for AI. I could ask five people in the corridor, you know, what is AI? And I would get at least six answers. And if you ask people, they won't really know. But if you give them applications, things they encounter in their daily lives or they've heard about that are applications of AI, they tend to have quite, like always when you survey the public, they tend to have quite sophisticated and quite nuanced views. Here are some of them. So this was a survey just before large language models. Of course, we're doing another one now, and there has been research into GPT, the use of GPT and so on. But it's early days, really, to know what the implications of those technologies are. And you can see some key kind of takeaways from this survey. It's online if anybody's interested. How do people feel about AI, it's called. We did it jointly with the Ada Lovelace Institute. So they do see benefits of 17 uses of AI technology. Benefits outweighed concerns for 10 of them. People are particularly excited about AI in health research as a way of diagnosing and assessing the risk of cancer. They can also see a lot of possible benefits in education, for example, the use of virtual reality. People are concerned at the same time, too. They're worried that doctors, for example, will rely too much on AI. And there's quite a bit of concern about advanced robotics, those kind of blue images that I showed at the beginning, particularly driverless cars, autonomous weapons, and robotic care assistants. They're worried about those as well. And interestingly, over 60% of people say that laws and regulation that prohibit certain uses of technologies and guide the use of all AI technologies would make them feel more comfortable with AI. And they're also worried about sort of clear procedures, kind of accountability. That dry academic word is really starting to mean something for people when it comes to AI. So those are how people feel, and there's research already out there which suggests that for large language models, there's similar sort of findings. And this is the public policy programme that I direct. And as I said, we are trying to help these technologies to be used to improve everybody's lives through better services, better decision making, better governance in general. So obviously, a survey like that, we need to take it very seriously and think, what is it that people want us to do? So this is the public policy programme. It was started about five years ago. It's grown a lot, I hope, strategically. We now have about 55 full-time Turing researchers and a lot of affiliated researchers from many universities. And we've worked with over 100 public sector organisations of all shapes and sizes, from central government departments to international organisations to local authorities. So I'm just going to give you a few snapshots of the kind of things that we're doing and say a bit more about AI along the way. So here are our four challenges that we set ourselves at the beginning. We went all over government talking to people about what they most kind of people in government, what would they most want from AI, and what are the kind of things that keep them awake at night and AI might help with, and what are the kind of concerns they have. And we found it divided into two. About half the questions we got related to technical capacity, because government has always struggled with big technology projects and developing technology more generally. So there were a lot of concerns about that. And then the other group of questions were should questions. What should we do with AI? There was a lot of concern about that too. So we wanted to tackle both of those in kind of four challenges: using data science and AI to inform policy making, improve the provision of public services, great possibilities there. Then build kind of ethical foundations to deal with those should questions, and contribute to policy that governs the use of data science and AI, but picking up on that concern from the public as well, that we should have policies to regulate these technologies. So I'll start with the first one. I think here our real aim is summed up perhaps in think back to the pandemic. There was lots of modelling, there was lots of data science, there were lots of graphs on the TV. The general public were looking at, you know, slideshows with lots of graphs and models and data. So as the National Institute for Data Science, we should have been super happy. Well, yes, some of us were like rock stars during that period. However, a lot of that modelling was about health data and the spread of the disease and about epidemiological models. What you saw far less of were models which modelled the social world and the economic world and tried to understand how these things, what the data tells us about what kind of decisions we should make. So a lot of the policies introduced at that time, from the furlough scheme to the loan scheme to the closing of schools and the economy more generally, those policies tended to be implemented without much evidence, because there couldn't be evidence. There isn't much research into non-pharmaceutical interventions at a national level for disease. So it was very difficult for policymakers. And really what we try and do here is build the kind of models that we wish policymakers had had at their disposal during that time. For example, in production networks, looking at supply chains, where are supply chains vulnerable? Labour mobility networks, which might enable us to design a furlough scheme next time with some evidence. models of international trade, the housing market, and so on. And this model of policy prioritisation, which is used by the UNDP to model which policies governments should prioritise to maximise the use of their resources when they want to meet their sustainable development goals. Public services, we've got a load of projects there. A lot of them are using a large language models. Huge interest in large language models right across government. If we do a webinar on large language models for government, you know, we can have 500 civil servants watching. And that's really exciting. When I wrote my PhD about government and technology, really nobody was very interested in it at all. I mean, obviously my supervisor and so on, but, you know, people in government weren't very interested, but they are now. They are interested in this generation of technology, and that's exciting. We're working with doctors to think about clinical adoption. We're using large language models to build better consultations between the government and the public. But the thing that people are most interested in, actually, is productivity. Huge interest in public sector productivity, and for obvious reasons, because there's huge possibility of AI to increase public sector productivity, which by many accounts has remained flat for many years. I should point out that for every technology, there's huge excitement about productivity. There is always a really big McKinsey report, and there's always lots of discussions about how you know you can save 30 billion or something. That's an exaggeration. But there's always kind of excitement about new generations of technology. But this time, we really do seem to be ways that the excitement might come real. So the way that we're thinking is about it is that public services revolve around service transactions, and there's a lot of them. So passport applications, 8 million a year, driving license, 2.5. And these are a challenge. Think how, you know, upset you get if your passport doesn't arrive. Think of the misery caused by the backlog of asylum applications. And of course, universal credit, 2 million a year, absolutely key to people's well-being and their ability to survive. So government is about making decisions about these things, but behind, and we tend to think that in quite a lumpy way in the past when it comes to technology. We try to sort of digitize a transaction like road tax or something like that, and then everyone gets excited for a while and then it becomes the norm. Well, that's great, but behind every transaction, there's a chain of sort of micro decisions, checking documents, triaging applications. And if we try and break those transactions down into those service tasks behind them, we found a huge numbers of tasks that actually it would be very low risk to automate. They're what's called routine cognitive tasks, that it would be relatively risk-free to automate. You've still got the human in the loop of the overall transaction, but some of it is automated. We're doing some work. The Central Data and Digital and Data Office at the Cabinet Office is working on this. We've been working with them. We've also been writing papers about it, because this is a huge kind of mapping exercise of all the transactions in government. But we do believe, actually, that round about 70 of the 200 million kind of micro tasks that I mentioned have very high possibility to be automated. So there are exciting opportunities there. I guess as we're in a place of measurement, I should mention that measurement is also really important here. We're not very good at measuring productivity. And if you can't measure it, you can't tell if you've improved it. So that will be crucially important in this. And the Office for National Statistics have just released some new data and analysis on that just today, I believe. Okay, I mentioned the should questions, really, really important. One of the things we set ourselves to do was to build the ethical foundations for the use of data science and AI in policy making. And here, it was there's a lot written about the ethics of AI. You can see why from those blue images I showed at the beginning. People have been worried about it for a long time. AI technologies can introduce bias. They can use biased data to make biased decisions. They run off, after all, human decisions from the past, and many of those were biased. So that means the decisions the technology make could be biased. They cause accountability problems. You saw that in that data from the survey. They cause transparency problems. They are what we call black box technologies. We don't really know what's going on exactly under the hood. Those are all things that need to be thought about and built into the design, development, and deployment of these technologies. That's probably the biggest team within the overall team. We've done a lot of work on it. I'll just mention two or three. We produced the UK government's official guidance on AI ethics. It's a kind of framework for the safe and ethical use of AI in the public sector. That's important because it's needed kind of in every department, every governmental organisation, every public sector organisation is thinking about those questions. One of the reasons I'm really proud of that guidance is I believe it was the first guidance of its kind in the world. It's also the most downloaded and therefore we hope more used, but also the most academically cited. And I think it's a nice example of where you can sort of bring research and policy together to improve things. I'm a great believer in that. We also produced the world's first guidance on explainability, working jointly with the Information Commissioner's Office. We've worked on bias in facial recognition technologies. We've worked with the Department of Health looking at inequity in medical devices, which is a growing problem. And we've worked with UNICEF creating the first ever guidance, ethical AI ethics guidelines for children, including a wonderful, do look at it, if you just look at one thing to follow up on this, take a look at our work with the Children's Parliament in Scotland, where we did these kind of, this work with children. There are wonderful videos of children having really interesting opinions about AI. We quite often forget about children when we talk about technology, and we really shouldn't. There are also questions of women in data science and AI, because there aren't very many of them. There's a really troubling absence, particularly in machine learning, as I said, are one of the core technologies behind AI. Only 8% of researchers who talk at prominent machine learning conferences are women, and less than 6% of venture capital goes to companies founded by women. Remember, it does matter who designs technology, who is behind the development and deployment of technology. We're learning that in a much more general sense, I think, during the COVID pandemic. During the COVID inquiry, it's been mentioned several times. And I'll come back to it at the end. It is a really important question and really hard one to tackle. This report has just come out on women, AI, and venture capital in the UK. We're really trying to think of solutions to this problem because it's a very hard nut to track. Finally, the question of regulation and governance. Almost every market is being shaped by artificial intelligence. And that has a profound effect for the kind of task of regulation. There isn't a single regulator who's not having to sort of tackle this question. Now, the very big regulators are massing huge capacity, like the Ofcom, the telecommunications regulator, has really, really developed an impressive capacity in data science and AI to tackle questions of online harm and to gear up for the Online Safety Act, previously the Online Safety Bill. We were doing a lot of work with Ofcom on those issues. Other big regulators like the Financial Conduct Authority and the Competition and Markets Authority are real innovators in tackling questions of AI in markets and developing AI themselves to do smarter regulation. But there's lots of regulators, and for the smaller ones are really struggling. You know, most regulators did not expect to become technology regulators, but they all are now. So if you think of something like the Equalities and Human Rights Commission or the Electoral Commission, that's a real challenge for them. And so this report over on the left is about thinking about that. What's the capacity they need, and how could you build it in some kind of central place so that regulators have access to that? Can I just ask about time? Did you want me to stop?
Fairly soon.
Okay, fine. So anyway, you can see the survey there, the work with Ofcom and so on. We also do a lot of work on the technical side of regulation, as I mentioned, actually building the technologies that you need to classify, detect online harms. These are things that large language models can really be expected to turbocharge. And so we do need to think about these things because they may not be existential risks, but they are really important risks that we need to tackle, particularly with health-related misinformation, for example. Large language models have the particular possibility to be sort of engines of misinformation, so that's very important. I think I'm a social scientist. Sorry, I didn't say that at the beginning in case you didn't listen to me hard enough. I am actually a social scientist and I believe passionately in multidisciplinary research. I think we need people who understand the social world as well as people. Of course we need people who can understand and develop the technology, but there are lots of social science tasks there and tasks relating to philosophy and law and so on. I do think that's very important. And sometimes we need to question the orthodoxy that that data science is a purely kind of science and technology engineering challenge. We also need to challenge the orthodoxy that AI is always about replacing humans, kind of turbocharging humans and then getting rid of the humans. There are lots of other things to be done that do not involve that. They involve kind of tackling some of the things that humans are absolutely rubbish about, like bringing together large sources of data, heterogeneous data sets, and getting insight out of lots of data sets at once. That's something AI can be brilliant at, humans not so much. And finally, I'll end there. This is the AI summit that was held in Bletchley Park 2 or 3 weeks ago. I'm very pleased I was at that summit on the first day. I would say, though, I was probably one of the very few social scientists there, count on one hand, probably. And this is the final day. I wasn't there at the final day. This was for world leaders and technologists. But you can see these are the real, there's some world leaders who were there, including our own prime minister. There's Ursula von der Leyen. But there are quite a lot of men in suits that you're not quite sure who they are. I can tell you, you know, there's Reid Hoffman, who's a wonderful man. I'm not saying anything about these people. Brad Smith is there from Microsoft. Sam Altman, the troubled Sam Altman from OpenAI, is there. Eric Schmidt, formerly of Google, is there. Elon Musk isn't there, but he was there. There's not a huge amount of diversity there, and there's not necessarily the kind of subtle understanding of the human world and what people really think and how they are experiencing AI and how we could get more women into AI. All the things I've talked about, I don't think they are really well represented there. So I think that is something for the future if we really want AI to make the world a better place.